Thank you so much. I appreciate this warm welcome, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. Let me go ahead and get this issue settled first thing, so that maybe it won't plague us. It's a real pleasure to be here with you. I'm just deeply honored. I'm not quite sure that I can follow up on what we just listened to in terms of the substance and just what a real honor and a pleasure it is. I remember I had the fortune to be able to take him in class. He actually taught me when he taught for a very short stint at Texas Christian University. He didn't actually ever teach there, but we worked out an agreement where they would allow me to allow him to teach me. And so I had that opportunity, which led to him taking me to some of these places. And it was just amazing. What a deep resource. And also contributing what you're offering to us with these PowerPoints is just invaluable. And so I very much appreciate that. I have a great appreciation for many of you that are here today. And there's so many stories that I would just like to spend the time swapping with, all the generosities that you've shown to me and the experiences that we've shared. It's just a really great chance to spend time with you. There was something you said that I thought about, and that was Epaphroditus when he walks into Rome. There's been two different occasions. One time when I was in Liberia and another time when I was in India. We were supposed to preach a gospel meeting in both cases. And I remember in the case in India, and it was just like this in Liberia too, we showed up in the town, I had my Bible, we left the hotel we were staying at, our host had picked us up, we had driven 2 hours, we showed up in the village, and then, I'm getting sort of internally geared up for preaching, and we stop into a place, my host, Vinay, gets out, and he runs in, and he goes and talks to somebody, he comes and gets back in the car, and says, "All right, let's go." Then he drives, we go a little bit further down the road, and he stops in another place, gets out, he runs in, he says, "I'll be just a minute." He's gone for 5 minutes, talks for a minute, comes back to the car, says, "All right, let's go." This goes on for about 45 to 50 minutes. And finally I say, "Vinay, what are we doing?" He says, "I don't know where the meeting is, and we're trying to find it." We go to this village, and they don't have addresses listed for each location. So he's just going to one shop after another saying, "Well, maybe they'll know these people or they'll know where it is." We did find the location in both cases, but that just gave me a little bit of foretaste. I mean, just, makes me think of that when we think about Paul's journeys. And one of the best things that you can do in your ministry, I would encourage you, is to travel just a little bit. Go on a mission journey. If you can, go to a developing nation. And all of a sudden, you'll end up in situations that you're sitting there going, "Wow, I just... Paul would have been through this type of situation like I'm dealing with." Or when you're stopped on the middle of a road trip to preach the gospel and you've got to stop because there's just a whole bunch of sheep going right across the road in front of you. And all of a sudden, and the amazing thing about it is you start into these sermons and you start trying to preach the parables, and your 45-minute sermon turns into a 5-minute sermon because you don't have to explain the parable to them. They already get the parable just on the first hearing of it. And you go, "Oh, now I get it. We're not an agriculturally based society. That's why we don't get it." And you go to an agricultural based society and they just get it. And it's really neat. But that's really what I want to communicate to you today. If we're wanting to understand the author, we need to put ourselves in situations textually and physically to understand Paul. Let's try to go to places where Paul's been. Well, let's say you can't do that. Well, I'm just saying, hold that thought out. If you get a chance, go on a mission trip. It will profoundly impact you. If we're talking about the author, though, we need to do two different things. Number one, we want to talk about the author of this text. Who's the author of this specific writing, Romans? Paul or Tertius, right? We don't really want to spend the next 45 minutes talking about Tertius, do we? No, we're talking about Paul. But there's another level to this. That he's the historical author that we know about, but there's a deeper question, a theological author behind the text as well. And we want to spend a few minutes thinking about that as well. That is God. God the author and what God is communicating. And I really loved the slide we had on hermeneutics, where the first, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. My 2 points are the historical author and the theological author. And so we're going to look at the context first and talk about Paul. And then we're going to look at the theological context, and we're going to talk about God and Scripture. Okay. So the first thing we're going to do is sort of step into the world of Paul and just try to think about him. And I'm not going to be comprehensive. I'm just going to do a potpourri of Paul, if that's okay. The texts that you really want to look at to learn about Paul are, first of all, you need to make a distinction between Paul's writings and Acts. And the reason I say you need to make a distinction is because between the two, Acts and Paul's writings, you're going to get a beautiful mosaic of who Paul is, but you can't fill in every detail. And we like to fill in every detail. Just to give you an example, Titus. Will somebody please tell me the verses in the book of Acts where Titus shows up? He doesn't. You see, so all of a sudden we realize Titus, who is a key and critical player in Paul's ministry, he's not part of the mosaic that we're getting in Acts, is he? So what that tells you is all of the details that you and I like to have, we're not going to get by gleaning through all of this information. So if you want to start thinking about Paul the person, we need to look at Philippians chapter 3, where he gives some biography there. We need to be looking at Galatians chapters 1 and 2. Paul gives a lot of biography there as well. We need to look at some of the texts in Romans, or the way he describes himself in Romans chapter 1. But he also does some description of himself in some of the later texts in the last few chapters of Romans, when he's really given this, you know, in chapter 11, when he's talking about his relationship to Israel. He talks a little bit about himself, his past. But the real key is Paul's theology when he starts talking about his present. And that's in Galatians 2 as well. When he describes himself, he's crucified with Christ. When he talks about his past in Philippians chapter 3, he considers it all rubbish. You see, that's important too. Not just his past, but his present. Or we can look at some of the other passages, especially Acts. I mean, what would we have if we didn't have Acts in terms of putting it all together? And in particular, he gets biographical in Acts chapters 22 and 23, and then at the very end of 21 as well, beginning in verse 37. These are the key places if you want to spend some time just jumping into Paul. And then there's that little comment that I just love in 2 Peter chapter 3, around verses 14 to 18. When after you've jumped into Acts and you've mapped him out, and then you spend all day reading his letters and you're thoroughly confused, then you can read 2 Peter and go, I knew I was on to something. His letters are difficult. You know, and Scripture sympathizes with me. You know, but that's important. It's important to realize that Paul was interpreted by his peers as convoluted, difficult to understand. Because it is sometimes difficult to understand. To make matters worse, there's been a whole slew of writings that have come out that have talked about whether or not, for instance, 2 Corinthians is 3, 4, or 5 letters or just one. Why do we have all these discussions? Because sometimes it's difficult to follow. You know, sometimes I wonder if maybe Paul was sitting down and he was writing these letters. And if, for instance, Philippians. What do we call Philippians? We call it the letter of joy. And then you get to chapter 3, verse 2, and he says, beware of the dogs, beware of the mutilators, beware of the circumcision, that these evil workers. And all of a sudden, he shifted gears so heavily, you're trying to figure out what in the world is joy, joy, joy. And then, this massive contrast. And then that happens in 2 Corinthians chapters 10 to 13. Did he have some bad barbecue? Yeah. Well, he probably wouldn't eat barbecue. But let me tell you, just maybe it was meatloaf or something, you know. But anyway, maybe did indigestion hit, or did Epaphroditus walk in and he's just in the best mood, and then Epaphroditus tells him this, that, and the other happened, and boom, he changes gears. I don't know all the reasons why. But some people have said, you know, Paul seems to have such a strong personality that sometimes he seems to be a little emotionally unbalanced. Well, what are they really trying to say? They're not really trying to say he's unbalanced. They're trying to say you're just getting this whirlwind immersion of emotion, and it's just profound. In fact, it's so profound, it's genius. It's not just genius. No, there's a word for it. There is a word for it. It's as if he's touched by God. It's as if he's God breathed. All of a sudden, we begin to realize that we're not just dabbling in what we know. When we start talking about the man Paul, well, we know that. But then we start dabbling in stuff we don't get. And all of a sudden, we realize we've got the mystery of God in our hands. And we know it's right there. And we wrestle with it. And then a year goes by, and then 5 years goes by, then 10 years goes by, then 20 years goes by, and guess what? We're still wrestling with the mystery of God. And many of the things that are most important, the essentials, are revealed to us. But at the end of the day, you and I know that there's us, and then there's God. And in terms of experiencing that, man, this is going to be awesome. But I'm not there yet. I still wrestle. I still look. I still inquire. I want to understand the mind of God. So I dig into Romans. I dig into Paul. You know, some of the things that we have about Paul, that some of the specifics are, you know, we know he's converted. He was a Jew. He's a Pharisee of Pharisees. And all of these different texts talk about these different things. But he's not just a Pharisee of Pharisees. Galatians says that he excels above his peers. I mean, he's just a go-getter, you know. And so, when he's on his way to Damascus, and unfortunately the map that I have is a little bit cut off here. Damascus is over here. He's headed up that way to persecute Christians. And then he has an experience, and I don't think I really have to rehash that story to all of you on the road to Damascus. And then that leaves him on a journey. And I like the fact that there is, you know, 10, 11 years where Paul does go back to his home area of Cilicia right up here. And we just don't know all the details. But I can only imagine Paul's probably going to try to study with family members, friends. I mean, if you just look at what we see him doing in Jerusalem or in Damascus, we see this just intense desire to spread this new gospel. The zeal that he once had for his forefathers has now been transferred over to his Christ. And he's sharing that message. But he's almost too hot to handle. Barnabas not being his name being Joseph, but he's so encouraging, it's kind of like, boy, Paul, you're a wonderful guy, but maybe you need to go somewhere else for a little while. You know, my encouragement can only do so much, and I can only ask people so many times to forgive you, and then it's going to be too much. And he goes off, but eventually, up here in Antioch, he comes back with Barnabas. Barnabas goes and gets him again. And they head off on some of these journeys together. I've always wondered exactly why they came down to this island right here first. But my hunch is that, if you notice, Joseph, also known as Barnabas, nicknamed by the apostles, he's a native of this island right here. And the reason I like this point is because whenever we decide we want to take the gospel to the world, the first thing that probably crosses our mind are, do I have any family or friends who haven't heard the gospel? And it's just a natural bridge, and that would have been natural for these guys too. But so they go on this journey, have great success and great opposition, and then they head back, and it's time to go again. And let's go on to the next slide. I think I've got another one. There's just a view of it that some of you've probably seen before. But then when they decide to go on this second journey, Barnabas wants to take John Mark with him, who had gone with them on the first journey part of the way, but had to go back. They have a sharp disagreement. And it's always encouraging for me to know, too, that we can have sharp disagreements. We can have sharp disagreements. Okay? And sometimes that means the same way that we handle at home. I think I'm going to go work, change the oil. I'm going to go work in the garage for a little while. Okay? Or maybe I should go to a different town and work. No, all of the disagreements don't have to mean we're just done with each other. That's it. Let's burn the bridge. Let's just blow it up. We can sometimes still work together and have sharp disagreements, can't we? Yes. Okay, so what do they do? So what does Barnabas do? Well, let's go back to Cyprus. And then what does Paul do? Well, it would have been instinctive for us too. He goes right up to Tarsus here. You know, he's going to come up into here. And then he keeps going through that area. And he heads up through this region, Galatia and Phrygia and Bithynia. And I really love the way we unpack Asia a little bit, because Paul wants to go to Asia, but the Holy Spirit does not allow him to go. And this is a really important point, a preaching point as well, because we have to remember this is God's mission. And we are getting involved in God's mission. See, whenever we like to get involved, oftentimes we like to run the show, but he's still running the show. And so Paul comes up to Troas, a traditional city that has a great heritage that they would have known, Troy. And he can't go where he wants to go. And so he has a vision and he heads across to Macedonia. And then here's what's so awesome about this. As he goes throughout Europe for the first time, establishing churches in Philippi, then over here, number 5, Thessalonica, then Berea, then coming down to Athens, and I've heard this interpreted different ways. It was a failed mission, but others have said, no, it was a success. He preached the gospel. Well, the one where he had the most meager results. He then goes on to Corinth. At all of these different points along the way, he's preaching and teaching the gospel, but there's a little caveat where I'm trying to really help us see the flavor of who Paul is when he's doing these things. And we have to go to Acts chapter 11 to see this. Acts chapter 11. Because remember how I told you there's all of the details that we want to put together, we don't get them all in the same place. And so here at the end of Acts, we have this prophet, Agabus, beginning in verse 27. He came down from Jerusalem to Antioch, and he makes a prediction that there's going to be a severe famine all over the world. Now, you and I, this is one of those details that you really need to go to the developing world to begin to appreciate. Now, when I just said there's going to be a severe famine, how many of you had just extreme levels of shock go through your system to where you remembered from your childhood the last famine? No, we didn't have that emotional response that we maybe should have had when we read that. Okay? Now, famine is like saying, it's like a death sentence, okay? And it hits, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it. And there are places in the world that do experience this today. And so, when we're talking about this, we realize that when Agabus says this, this is a big deal. A really big deal. Keep going. Verse 29, the disciples determined that according to their ability, each would send relief to the believers living in Judea. This they did, sending it to the elders by Barnabas and Saul. So here we already begin to see Barnabas and Saul getting involved in raising funds for the poor of Jerusalem who are going to be undergoing this famine. I'd like to go over to Galatians chapter 2 next to see the follow-up on what we see Paul talking about here. But early in Paul's ministry, when he finally does go down to Jerusalem and he meets face-to-face with the pillars of the church, who are the pillars? It's Peter, James, the Lord's brother, and John. I mean, man, can you imagine that meeting? You know, the three of them ganging up on him. I mean, I'm sure they were embracing him with love, but still, just the intimidation of going to a meeting with these people, you know. I mean, wouldn't you just be dying to go, James, can you tell me a funniest story when y'all were kids? You know, or something like that. These people know, they know deep within their core who Christ is. And then after they have this sit down around verse 9, what's fascinating is what they're interested in. And when James and Cephas and John, who were acknowledged pillars, recognized the grace that had been given to me, they gave to Barnabas and me the right hand of fellowship, agreeing that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. They asked only one thing, that we remember the poor, which was actually what I was eager to do. I mean, you have this meeting and they ask one thing of you, one thing, would you please just remember the poor? I mean, that's a tall order. This is not just an afterthought. This is not something in the verse that if you blink, it's gone. It didn't really happen. This is the pressing issue as the backdrop of the text, okay? And the reason this is important is because this is an undergirding factor that goes through Paul's mind everywhere he goes. I will preach the gospel here. I need to remember the poor. What can we do for the poor? Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 16 with me for just a moment. Let's look at, this is a passage that we're very familiar with, but when we put it in this context, all of a sudden, all of these rich flavors begin to come out as we saute it. Verse 1, now concerning the collection for the saints. Now, you and I, this is a little footnote. Normally when we talk about Christians today, we talk about them and use the word Christians. Well, when they talk about it, what's the word they use most of the time? Saints. Saints. Okay. So that's what we've got here. The collection for the saints. You should follow the directions I gave to the churches of Galatia. Don't forget where Galatia is, okay? Right there. Galatia. Paul's work there. On the first day of every week, each of you is to put aside and save whatever extra you earn so that collections need not be taken when I come. And when I arrive, I will send any whom you approve with letters to take your gift to Jerusalem. Now where's the gift going to go? Jerusalem. If it seems advisable that I should go also, they will accompany me. So Paul's perfectly content for representatives to take this gift on down there without him going. In fact, it probably would save him a journey if he could. So Paul's making these trips, and he makes another one, but he's always bent on getting back to Jerusalem. He's got work that's to be done over here. But you know, I kind of wonder sometimes, if you were to sit Paul down and say, Paul, what was your ministry? If you could summarize what you did for the church, your contribution, Paul, he's not going to say, I wrote letters that became scripture. He's probably not going to say, I'm the first missionary to go to Europe. He's probably not going to say, I brought the church to Ephesus. He might have. He's probably going to say, I didn't forget the poor in Jerusalem. I played my role. You see what I'm saying? It's going to be a pivotal point. Yes, he's going to say, I brought the gospel to the Gentiles. I know that. And that'll be the point we'll make later. But up there, as important is, I fulfilled my vow. Paul's a man of his words, what I'm trying to tell you. He gave his word to some people about 10, 15, 20 years ago, and here he is later. I'm keeping my word. I'm keeping my word. That's an important detail that we need to take note of. If you want to see more about Paul, this fundraiser, look at 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, and I won't read any of that right now, but these are those giving passages that really just overflow. And you know, one of my favorite parts about thinking about these passages is when Paul's making these rounds, I can only imagine when we get to Acts chapter 20, in the first few verses of Acts 20, and he's trying to decide how to get there, and he's trying to gather all of these monies to get sent back, and the thoughts got across his mind, where's the closest Western Union so that we can go ahead and send a wire transfer in advance? No, that's not it. I'm sorry, church in Corinth, we can't use Western Union. Will you cut me a check? No, it's not a check either, is it? How's he going to get the money there? Bags of golds. Slapped over the shoulders. You know, look at this coin right here. I think we know this coin. This is a quarter, okay? How many of these do I need to buy enough food to feed people in a famine? Now, I understand coins have different values. But how many of y'all have ever been backpacking? Where you like walk in 4 or 5 miles and then you set up camp and you come out the next day. How much weight you put on your back?
Little as possible.
Little as possible. I went last week in with my son for Boy Scouts, and I think I probably had, I went in with 30 or 40 and I went back out with about 25 or 35. We ate. I guess I still had it with me. But it's a lot of weight. Now, if Paul's traveling town to town, he's got to carry a few essentials with him. He can't depend on people like John Mark to always bring him his garments or his parchments or whatever he may need. But not only does he need to bring essentials, does he have a pack animal? I don't know. Is he going by road most of the time? Well, he's going by road and by sea, and both are risky. What do you think the story that Jesus tells about the man going down to Jericho gets robbed? Why does that resonate so much? Because it's a massive risk. You know, when I drove here today, I drove about an hour and a half, and I had this little thing in my pocket right here. And for all practical purposes, somebody could have waylaid me and taken this from me. And if they didn't harm me physically, I would be just fine. Why? I'll just get on a phone and call my bank and cancel the card. What do you think Paul's going to do when he's traveling down the road with bags of gold or whatever type of silver it may be, and he's afraid he's going to be waylaid? I tell you what, you're talking about an intense amount of fears. And we're not only talking about fears, we're talking about physical work. Hard work. So when we get over to passages like Acts chapter 20, I love to read these passages. Verse 1, after the uproar had ceased, Paul sent for the disciples, and after encouraging them and saying farewell, he left for Macedonia. There we are. See, here's Macedonia. Think Philippi and places like that. When he had gone through those regions and had given the believers much encouragement, he came to Greece. Okay, here we are, Greece, Achaia, that area. All right, let's keep going. Where he stayed for 3 months. He was about to set sail for Syria when a plot was made against him by the Jews. Now, that sounds like an excellent solution if you've got a lot of money to carry. If we get it on the ship, and if we can make it across without the ship sinking, we'll at least have the security that somebody's not going to rob me on the ship, because where are they going to go? And these are not these massive, wonderful, seaworthy vessels that you and I think about when we think of ships. We're talking about little things that we would go, you're going to get in that and sail across that sea? But it's still, it's not the land route. It's a better route. So we keep going here, and what happens? There was a plot that was set up against him, and so what does he do? He decides to return by land through Macedonia. But it's the list of names that intrigues me the most about this. He was accompanied by Sopater, son of Pyrrhus, from Berea. By Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica, these two places up here. By Gaius from Derbe. And by Timothy, as well as by Tychicus and Trophimus from Asia. They went ahead and were waiting for us in Troas, and so on and so forth as they make their journey back. This is interesting for several reasons. How many people did we count up here? Is it seven? Seven. He's got an entourage. You know, are you going to try to take these funds from him when you have that many people? He's got a whole entourage to protect him to get back. But the best part about it is where they come from. Could Paul have ever imagined that as he went on these journeys to all of these places, starting these works, that one day he would be talking about shoulder-to-shoulder compatriots, carrying out the mission of God, fulfilling promises that he had made to Jerusalem, and taking the gospel to places that it had never been before? Can you imagine? Can you imagine? What an exciting feeling that would have been to be Paul. But this just gives us an idea of some of the activities that Paul was involved in and what he was engaged in when he was just carrying out the work of God and what he thought was important. This is the author of Romans. And I don't think we really even have to set up some of the specifics of Romans as we're looking at this. I think we've done that quite well. But we can look at just one or two details and then we can bring all of this to a conclusion in the next 15, 20 minutes or so. Can you say conclusion in 15 or 20 minutes? Okay. Okay. That's right. Yeah. Like 1 Thessalonians, he says farewell in the very middle of the whole letter. Like, finally, brothers. Okay. Look at verse 1 with me. Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, which he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures, the gospel concerning his Son, who is descended from David according to the flesh, and was declared to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness by resurrection from the dead. Jesus Christ, our Lord, through whom we have received grace and apostleship to bring about the obedience of faith among all the Gentiles. Paul, I thought you were just saying, hey, my name's Jeremy Berry, how you doing? And then all of a sudden we're just in this, woo! You see it? You see Paul? I mean, he just can't even say his name without going off into what Jesus Christ has done. I mean, if nothing else gives me flavor of Paul, it's that right there, just the beginning of the letter. And he started it out with such humble beginnings, a servant of Jesus Christ. And as soon as he says Jesus Christ, he just lets loose. He just lets loose. What else can be said? You know, the other thing that I like the way Paul is, the way he thinks of himself, set apart for the gospel of God. And when we look at the way he talks about being set apart in the book of Galatians chapter 1, it's very similar. He does this in Romans 2, not Romans chapter 2, but he does it also in the book of Galatians and Romans, where he talks about being set apart. But it's the way that he talks about it that it's so fascinating to me. He talks about it as if he's set apart from his mother's womb. There's a word that we would use for that, and it's a little bit graphic, but I think it makes a point. It's almost as if he said, I was put into a womb, and I was supposed to do this, that, and the other, and all of a sudden God aborted me and took me out and put me somewhere else. Now, that's a real interesting way of thinking. That is the Greek word that where we get the word abortion as well. And when he talks about this, it's like he's saying, you know what, I was just set on a path. I knew who I was. I was fine with my identity. I was fine with the work that I was doing. I was thrilled to be serving God. And then all of a sudden, The same God who I thought I was serving said, let's tweak it and let's do it differently. And then his wheels are spinning and he sat back down and he runs on the new path. And it's almost like he's saying, I don't know where I'm going. This is wild. This is amazing. I'm following God's lead. But I thought I had it all figured out. And that's really, really important in ministry, that we learn to respect God's autonomy and we go with it. Because, man, I never would have imagined where I would have been or have been or am right now and what I'm doing. It's not anything of my design. And most of you, I think, can agree with me. We're not designing and calculating the ministry walks that we go down. But that's par for the course. And it's so par for the course that Paul, when he introduces himself, almost puts it in his title. I'm the guy who was set apart to do this. I don't have all the reasons why I work that way, but this is what I'm doing. Not only that, but Paul, poor, poor Paul, in so many ways. Look in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and 12. I mean, really? Shipwreck? My goodness. How many times? Think about this. He's been beaten. Man, he had a much better course that he was on, that he had picked out. Look at the one that God sent him down. And for what reason? Well, this actually cuts to the core of the way Paul thinks about Christ. I want us to go back to Galatians chapter 2 again for a minute. We see Paul saying, I've been crucified with Christ, this verse 19, 20. Nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith. I'm just trusting in the Son of God because it's completely out of control for me. But what's so key about this is let's pull Romans into this. There's a concept that comes into Romans that just baffled me for years when he starts talking about the Jews. And chapter 9, I'm speaking the truth in Christ. I am not lying. My conscience confirms it by the Holy Spirit. See, there's that other author we got to talk about. I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish in my heart. For I could wish, listen to this, for I could wish that I myself were accursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my own people, my kindred according to the flesh. Paul's just crossed the line for most of my life. What do you mean by that? Well, listen, you can do everything you can to save this kind of person and the other, but at the end of the day, you better save yourself. Now, that doesn't gel with what Paul just said. You see what I'm saying? You know, in fact, when you look at passages like Philippians, when he talks about salvation, let's turn there. We'll come back to Romans. Philippians chapter 2. I want you to just see it. Philippians chapter 2, verse 12. Therefore, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed me, not only in my presence, but much more now in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. And the your own right there is not in the singular, it is in the plural. You work out your own salvation. Why is that an important point? Because Paul's saying, I'm not going to go down if we don't go down together. And you're not staying up unless we stay up. He took fellowship seriously is what I'm trying to tell you. He believed in the team. He believed in other Christians. He believed in them even when they didn't believe in him. And he fought for the cause together. But I still don't quite understand this, Romans chapter 9. You'd be willing to be accursed? Well, see, we have to put this together with other things he says like Galatians 2 and realize that if you were to ask Paul, the only way to salvation is death. The only way to salvation is to be cursed on a tree. That's what Christ did, and that's what we do. We die to ourselves. And Paul says, I will give my life for my people in the same way that Christ gave His life for me. He traded it all. And Paul's saying, we got to trade it all. We give our lives. This is Paul's more than I can handle in so many ways. Which takes me all the way back to the first point. It's just astounding to read his words. But there's another layer to this. It's more than Paul, isn't it? It's what God is saying to people. And what is God saying to people in Romans? What is He using this specific text to tell us? You know, I've had the opportunity, and I know you have as well, to spend time with people that you love and appreciate. And you've spent a lot of time with them. Maybe it's a family member or a friend, or it could be your father or a mentor that you've had. And you feel like you really know them. Maybe you've been on a hunting trip with them, or maybe you've been to some retreat with them, or maybe you've had dinner with them with their family. And you've seen them when they're on and you've seen them when they're off, you know? And then there are some people that you wish you could spend more time with, but you don't really get to, and you only see them in just certain moments. And you're not quite sure you really know who they are. You see, you just get a glimpse of them. Just a moment. And so you have just that moment where you're trying to interpret more of them through that moment. And so when we all of a sudden go from Paul moving out to God's guidance of writing this document, all of a sudden we realize when we read these writings here, we're only seeing the pen going to paper in one specific case, and all of a sudden we realize it's embodied within all of these other writings where we get to see God laid out before us through the Old Testament and the New Testament. We see God's character as He deals with Abraham. We see God as He deals with David. And then here in this specific case, just a glimpse, in Romans, we see how God is dealing with humanity, with Paul, and with the Romans. And so it's so exciting to put the author in context, God's writings. So if I can narrow down Romans to one thing that I think God is telling us through this text, well, that's pretty easy, isn't it? Do I really have to say it? Romans chapter 1, verses 16. I mean, who hasn't preached this? For I'm not ashamed of the gospel. You know, and the real powerful part about this gospel, I remember the first time the power of God was opened up to me with this passage. I was preaching at a gospel meeting in India, and the brother I was with, he was introducing me to people who were there to hear the gospel. And I was shaking their hands and trying to learn their names. And Brother Swami said to me, he says, "This is so-and-so." I said, "Hey, so-and-so, how are you doing?" And he said, "Brother so-and-so is going to become a Christian today." And I said, "Great, that's wonderful. Brother Swami, how do you know that?" He says, "Because you're going to preach the gospel, and it is the power of God." I'm like, oh, no. And then all of a sudden, I mean, we had 52 baptisms at that gospel meeting. And Brother Swami he just so understood that the word dynamite, you know, "Man, you let this off. You don't know what's going to happen. Yeah, everybody doesn't get baptized, I know that. But as soon as the gospel comes out, man, it's dynamite. That's the power of God." And Paul says, "By no means am I ashamed of that. That's like telling my son not to play with fire." Sure, I'll play with fire. I'll preach the gospel. But here's the kicker. It's the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith. To the Jew first and also to the Greek. And there's the point when we get Romans. Because all of a sudden, if all of these Christians, these Jews who had to leave the capital city, they start filtering back after Claudius is gone. And all of a sudden we get churches of the Gentiles, Romans chapter 15. And then we probably have some churches of the Jews. Because you've got to keep in mind, they don't even have facilities like this. You understand what I'm saying? They're not all cramming into some big auditorium with a sign up front that says Church of Christ. They're ducking into small places wherever they can get, and they gather, and they're not going to be just tons of people there. And we have this dissension that arises, and we need somebody to stand up and say that the gospel is for everyone, and then Paul goes through the process of articulating how it is for the Jews and for the Gentiles. And then we can read his very last words, the final doxology, beginning in verse 25 of chapter 16. "Now to God, who is able to strengthen you according to my gospel and the proclamation of Jesus Christ, according to the revelation of the mystery that was kept secret for long ages, but is now disclosed." Paul, what is the secret? What's the secret? What's been disclosed? "And through the prophetic writings is made known dun, 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 to all the Gentiles, according to the command of the eternal God. I mean, the eternal God. You think God hadn't thought about it? To bring about the obedience of faith to the only wise God through Jesus Christ, to whom be the glory forever. Amen. I would yell that, but I'm losing my voice. There he is right there, to the Gentiles. You know, when I start thinking about what God is telling me, he's not just telling me that Paul wanted to go to a church. I mean, he's not trying to just describe to me how Paul went to this Roman church to tell them how the gospel is for Jews and Gentiles. He's trying to tell us something. What is he telling us? He's telling us what we know. And probably what they knew too. That the gospel is for all. I think of places like Vietnam. I've been able to travel there for about the last... Oh, man, we're going... We don't need to be scrolling yet. Maybe it'll hold there. Look how many people live there. The population is actually higher than this now. It's almost 90 million. You know, I can count on my fingers and my toes the number of Christian missionaries that I'm aware of who travel there. For 90 million people. Let's do the math. 90 million divided by 20. That's a lot of people to preach to. And it's not just there. There's other places as well. But I think about the place like Vietnam because I think about our relationship as a country to them and how we were involved there in the 1960s and even earlier. And then how we left there around 1975. You know, what's fascinating about this is there's a man by the name of Leonard Blake who lives not all that far from here, who lived and worked with the church in Vietnam in the 1960s and had to leave. And then from 1975 up through the mid-1990s, it was almost like imagining everything you've invested in your entire ministry, and then all of a sudden you're pulled out of it, and no hellos, no cards, no how you doing. I haven't heard from them in 20 years, and in fact, I don't even know if they're alive. Leonard decided, you know, I want to try to go back to Vietnam and see if I can connect with his brethren. See, the fascinating thing about history is we don't know how it's going to unfold, and we leave this country, and they set up major business relations with the Soviet Union. And that works great until about 1989. And then what happens? The Soviet Union crumbles. And they need some trade or they're all going to starve. And so who do they go to? They go to China. Well, what have they been doing with China for the last 15, 20 years? Putting them off. The Soviet Union does us better. So what did China do to them? I'm not going to trade with you. So guess who Vietnam talks to next? They talk to us. They talk to the United States. Can you believe that? And it takes over 10 years and we reestablish diplomatic relations and trade relations with Vietnam and all of a sudden it's the mid-90s and we're traveling to Vietnam. And what's amazing about this is brothers started going in and trying to reconnect with brothers, and they're finding them. They're finding that the church survived. You know, and this picture right here in particular was one of the congregations that we visited. This man right here, he's 95. He was 93 at the time. And I remember sitting and listening to him talk as the church gathered here. Look, we've got 3-4 generations now since then. It was 1974, and he and his business partner were sitting down and they saw what was happening and they had to make a decision. Do we try to keep our business here in Saigon or do we go to the country where we think we might be safer? They decided to go to the countryside. They moved their business out there. In fact, they completely refashioned their business in a whole new way. And what do? They take soybeans and they turn it into tofu. Okay? So they go out to the countryside. They endure it. Different members of their family at different times end up going through re-education camps. But most of them eventually make it back. And they continue to preach and continue to teach. And that church in Ben June is still there. Now his business partner passed away. But his business partner had a son whose name is Dong. And Dong is a gospel preacher. And Dong had a son, On. and On is a 24-year-old gospel preacher finishing up his training in Singapore right now. And so, when we think about the gospel is for all, that's right. It even means Vietnam. It means Saudi Arabia. It means India. It means China. It even means Alabama. You see, it's everywhere. It needs to go everywhere. And I think that's what God's trying to tell us. One of the things, anyway. There's many things He's telling us. But when we read Romans, it's not this little church here, it's not this little church there. The gospel's for all, whether it be Jew or Greek. I think that's all that I have for you this morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Excellent. Excellent presentation. We'll take another 10-minute break, and then we'll have Bruce McCarty speak to us, and after that, we'll walk across the way to lunch. So we'll take a 10-minute break.
Wonderful, Jim. Good to see you.
Thanks so much.
I tell people it's never about cultures are great, but it's people. It's always been about people. Mm-hmm. Fall in love with people. Paul traveled as he did because he fell in love with people.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you too. I'm so glad. Yeah.
Very good presentation. I've been to that church over in Vietnam.
Really?
Yeah, sure have. I was over there in 2006. He preached and taught.
Tell me your name.
Chuck Workman.
Chuck Workman. Wow.
Yeah. In fact, we had a difficulty in meeting with them because at that time, you know, they were still being harassed and everything. And so we had to actually sneak over there and meet with them in the back room on the third floor someplace.
Wow.
And we studied with them. Wonderful people. Beautiful people.
I'm so glad to get to talk to you.
Yeah.
Now that you've been over there too.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome.
We've been a lot of places. Been to Poland. Taught in Poland for a while.
Really?
Yeah.
Chuck was your first?
Chuck. Yeah. I served as one of the elders.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
that's excellent.
Your presentation was great. Really
thank
great.
You. I appreciate it. I really appreciate you sharing
it's been
that.
My office changed a lot. I may have to call you back.
That's his guy.
I was trying to remember the older ones. I can't remember his name, but I met him. He was quite an enthusiastic.
Thanks,
this is protected. This has been since Turkey, Israel, Egypt. It's been for everything. So it's kind of, it looks like me. It's kind of like the best of all.
I went to Egypt
I'm James Ingram. You remember me.
I do.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Your dad was Wayne and your mom was
Janet. That's right.
Yeah, you're a Pine Grove, Pine Hills.
That's right.
You and your brother and your sister.
And yeah, that's
and
amazing. That's amazing. Well, I saw you back there. Where are you living now?
Here, just south of